This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. Thank you for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. There's no doubt being a parent is challenging. Some of those challenges have always existed. Some are new to the 21st century. We worry about the health of our children, and if we're lucky enough to have healthy children, we worry about their successes in life. Today, the pressure on parents and children to succeed has escalated dramatically. After we've given away the Baby Einstein videos and played all the brain-boosting music we can stand, the next campaign is to prepare our kids for future achievement. The pressure to get into a good college or university becomes paramount. SAT scores, extracurricular activities, volunteering, summer courses to get ahead, tutoring, test prep, it can be grueling for the entire family. And at what cost? My guest says tiger parenting, defined as being extremely strict for the one basic goal of success, is causing serious mental health issues. She says no group displays more human craziness and mindless functioning than 21st century parents. Today we're talking with Dr. Shimi Kang. She's the medical director for child and youth mental health for Vancouver and a clinical associate professor at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Kang is an award-winning Harvard-trained doctor. She's the author of the number one bestseller, The Dolphin Way, about raising healthy, happy kids. Her latest book, just out and in paperback, is The Self-Motivated Kid, How to Raise Happy, Healthy Children Who Know What They Want and Go After It Without Being Told. Dr. Shimi Kang joins us today by phone from Vancouver. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So many of us are familiar with the term tiger mom after the media attention following the 2011 book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother by Yale Law professor Amy Chua. But before your book, I had never heard of jellyfish or dolphin parents. So I thought we should start by explaining what you mean. Can you introduce us to the different parenting styles you talk about in the book?
Yes, absolutely. So if we start with the tiger parent, the reference you just mentioned is one type of tiger. And when we think of the tiger, let's think of the classic term authoritarian. The authoritarian parent can be pushy and directive, like Amy Chua depicted in her book, but it can also be authoritarian protective, and that would be this current term of the helicopter parent. So authoritarian directing or authoritarian protecting, either way, the tiger parent is overbearing, and they're taking over what we call internal motivation, self-motivation, internal drive by too much pushing and too much hovering. On the opposite end of that spectrum would be what we call the permissive parent, or I use the metaphor jellyfish parent. So if you think of the jellyfish lacking structure, lacking focus, lacking rules, these permissive parents do the same, and their children end up with lots of problems like impulse control, and in fact, we know more risk-taking, greater drug and alcohol issues. And the balance between these two extremes would be the authoritative parent, or the metaphor would be the dolphin parent. This is a parenting style that's firm yet flexible. Unlike the jellyfish, there are rules and expectations and structure, but unlike the tiger, there is room for flexibility, autonomy, creativity, choice, independent thinking, mistakes, failure. It's a very collaborative relationship. So that's kind of an easy way, an easy visual, the tiger, dolphin, jellyfish, to understand these three classic parenting styles. And in fact, they're not even parenting styles, they're interpersonal styles. So I speak to corporations, and you can have a tiger boss, a jellyfish boss, or a dolphin boss. And depending on the style, you'll see the workplace environment very different.
To illustrate some of the negative effects of tiger parenting, you tell a story in the book about Albert and his mother, Winnie. Would you mind telling that story for us?
Sure, yeah. So I was called to do an assessment on a 14-year-old boy for unlawful confinement of a female. And when I showed up, the police had called me. I found out that the female that was unlawfully confined was Albert's mother. Her name was Winnie, and he had confined her to their basement of their home. And she was okay. She had food. There was a fridge down there, and she had a bathroom. But he kind of locked her down there and told me that he needed a break from his mom. He's like, she is constantly on me for homework or for piano or for whatever it is. And he said to me that his choice choice was to either lock her in there or go jump off a bridge. Now, you got to remember, he's 14, so his coping skills were not the best, but he felt so desperate. And my initial reaction, of course, was like, oh my God, what a tiger mom. Like, what kind of parent is this where life gets to this level? But then when I interviewed Winnie, you know, I really felt empathy for her because her story was such that she told me that before Albert was even born, when she was pregnant with him, she felt pressure to eat the right foods, to make sure that she was developing his brain in a healthy way. They had originally lived in China, and she was saying there's pressure to get into the right preschool by age 2. You have to know your colors, and you have to know your numbers. And her whole life became around Albert, getting him into the next school, getting him to the next level, getting him to the next level of performance. And it took over, and it was all coming from a place of love because she wanted the best for him, and all of society's messages were telling her that the best means more, more pushing, more performance. Anyway, the story ends quite well because we were able to work with Albert and his mom and really just balance out their lifestyle. And what Winnie could see was, of course, it was backfiring because not only was their relationship strained, but Albert was becoming addicted to video games. He was eating a lot of junk food. He kind of needed the latest gadget. He was being overindulged because he was being bribed for academic performance. So everything they were trying to achieve was completely backfiring. We know this is true. It happens all the time in all of the studies with pushy parents. So they were able to balance their lives out a bit. I reintroduced some concepts like play, free play exploration for the sake of fun, for the sake of learning. I introduced the concept of connection, bonding, just spending time together has nothing to do with performance. Talks a lot about sleep and downtime. And ultimately, they got their lives back on track.
You say it's not about choosing between a low-achieving, happy child or a high-achieving, miserable child.
Yes. I think what's happened is the conversation has become an either or. Do you want success or happiness? That's a false choice. We absolutely don't have to choose one or the other. And in fact, if we really back up here and look at the big picture, how can you have success without happiness? So I think we have to first redefine success from a parenting perspective, especially as the health of our children is increasingly becoming the victim here. We're seeing rising rates of things like anxiety, depression, obesity, diabetes, addiction, including video game addiction, technology addiction. All of this is on the rise, even though we've never had such parental involvement in our children's lives. So I say it's a paradox, and it really isn't my opinion, but it really is the basic science of doing this, and we don't have to choose.
You mentioned depression and substance abuse. Do you mind if I quote something from the book? Because there are some scary statistics in here.
Mm-hmm.
You say stress and mental illness are on the rise, and young people between the ages of 15 and 24 are the most affected. By the year 2020, depression is on track to be the number 2 cause of disease in the Western world and would be second only to heart disease. Prescription drug abuse is among the top health problems in the developed world, with youth in college being the fastest growing subgroup. More young people die of suicide than homicide and war combined.
Yes, I think, it is great that we're talking more about mental health and there is more awareness than ever before, but we still have a long way to go. And those stats really show how important and how prevalent this is. 1 in 4 people on the planet will experience a mental health crisis in their life. And the highest group is that 15 to 24-year-old. We know college students are at high risk for binge drinking, for prescription drug use, for stimulant use. And that those suicide rates are real. And these are occurring not just in America, but across the world. And in fact, you can see a correlation in places where children and youth are pushed harder, places like South Korea and China and India, we're seeing higher rates of student suicide. So there is that correlation with pressure, for sure, and these mental health problems.
You acknowledge the pressure that parents and children feel about getting into the right college. The message to parents is that your kid has to be an expert at something or run a small country to get into a competitive university. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, it's easy to understand the anxiety parents often feel about not having their children involved in enough. I'm sitting in a studio within walking distance to Yale. I see parents of young children rushing to get their kids to the next music lesson, dance rehearsal, swim practice. The kids often look very tired, and the parents are so rushed they practically knock you over.
Mm-hmm.
But it's reality. What do you say to parents who are feeling that very real pressure?
There's no doubt there is more pressure than ever before. It is harder to get into university. It's harder to get these scholarships. The world has become more global, more competitive. I have three children. I feel the same. I have very high expectations for them, you know, not just academic or professional, but like I said, in health and happiness. But one thing that I think parents are missing is, and I end up saying this a lot to my patients, is if you're too busy to have routine regular sleep, or if you're too busy to have routine regular downtime, just some quiet moments in your day, then you and your child is not just too busy to be healthy, but they're too busy to be brilliant. They're too busy to be performing at their optimal level, because no matter how much we try to talk about pressure, we cannot deny our basic biology. You know, we are living beings, and our brains and our biology functions in a certain way. And we know that our brain responds to stimulation and performs better. But when we are overstimulated, when we're overstressed, when we're overbusy, when we're overtired, we see a dramatic drop in our optimal brain performance. So that's one thing I think parents need to know, that more is not better. It's just like a muscle. If you're training an elite athlete, we know we can't push them till the very edge. We know that they need training interspersed with rest and stretching and all of that to get them to their peak performance. And that's just the way the body works. Our brains are very similar. The other thing I think that's really important right now is to recognize that even though the school system hasn't changed, even though we still have these standardized test scores, et cetera, the work environment, the 21st century world has changed, and the key skills for the 21st century, in the book, I coined them as CQ, as in consciousness quotient, but they're creativity, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking. These are very clear. They're well-defined. They're well-researched. This is what's on every job posting and interview for graduate school. This is what people are looking for: creativity, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking. And if we're keeping our kids so instructed with tutors, they're not going to develop critical thinking or creativity. And if they're constantly being told what to do, they're going to lack the development of proper communication and collaborative skills. So ultimately, we have to really think what we're looking for. And some of it's pressure, but some of it is mindlessness. I think we're just doing it because everyone else is doing it and not stopping to think. And a lot of it is marketing. Parents are a very big market. So if we think about all of where the pressure's coming from, it's coming from a lot of different areas.
And as you just alluded to, it sounds like colleges and universities are also starting to change what they're looking for. The overscheduled, overachieving child looks good on paper, but you're hearing things from college admissions directors that suggest they're starting to look beyond things like test scores and structured activities.
Yes, I extensively researched what are colleges actually looking for and what are administrators saying. And there's this term that came out of the University of California system, and they're calling the kids that are showing up on their campus Crispies and Teacups. And what they're referring to there, the Crispy is the 19-year-old or the young person who has been, quote-unquote, working since they were 4 or 5. They've been doing tutoring and piano and soccer and gymnastics. And they show up in their first year of university or college, and they're burnt out. They're burnt to a crisp. They have nothing left to offer. They're not interested in learning. It was all about getting in. That's not what they want. The other term is the teacup. And the teacup youngster is someone who's been bubble wrapped or overprotected or helicoptered, and they are fragile. They are easily breaking like a teacup, and they lack resilience. And so they don't get the right class in college. Things fall apart. And the college mental health centers are flooded with Crispies and teacups. So I think that we're at the point where the administrators realize this. And then when we look at who ultimately becomes successful, who are the leaders, who are the individuals who are innovating and creating? These are individuals that have the right balance of work and rest, who understand that optimal peak performance in this current age, the 21st century, this isn't a factory model where we can just put more hours in and it's a very, what we call a linear rote task. the tasks of this time are very abstract. They're very what we call cognitive flexibility. We need to be able to think in all directions. And that's a different skill set. And it does not work if you're a crispy or a teacup.
Hmm. This is Dr. Shimi Kang. She's an expert on human motivation. She's a Harvard-trained child psychiatrist. Her latest book is called The Self-Motivated Kid. It's about how to guide your child to develop self-motivation and a balanced life. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in today for Faith. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. Today we're talking with Dr. Shimi Kang. She's the medical director for Child and Youth Mental Health for Vancouver. And we're talking about her new book, just out and in paperback. It's called The Self-Motivated Kid, How to Raise Happy, Healthy Children Who Know What They Want and Go After It Without Being Told. In the introduction, I quoted you as saying, no group displays more human craziness and mindless functioning than 21st century parents. Can you talk a little about what you do and what led you to come to this conclusion?
Yeah, so I've been a psychiatrist for over 12 years, and I'm the medical director of an entire city overseeing over 6 mental health clinics. So I work with parents and young people from all socioeconomic classes, all cultures, all walks of life. And what I've come to believe and see, and in fact the research shows this as well, is there is a parenting trend, this over-parenting trend, I say is seriously under-parenting. I actually liken it to an addiction because my research and background was originally in addiction, and that's how I got interested in motivation. And I said to myself, if we can get an 18-year-old depressed young guy who's addicted to cocaine off these drugs, we can use the same techniques to get our kids to do their homework or to excel in whatever they're trying to achieve. And we don't need to be pushy tiger parents. We can come from this dolphin collaborative approach. But the parents, I say, have become, in many ways, I use the term addicted to performance. And when we look at the criteria of addiction, we say there's 3 things. There's negative consequences, out of control behaviors, and intense cravings. And when you look at the negative consequences of what's happening to young people, that's really clear. Mental health issues are on the rise, and also physical injuries. So kids are being injured more now in competitive sports than ever before. So the consequences are clear. And the out-of-control behaviors, the parents tell me, they're like, look, I promised I wasn't going to bring up performance or test scores or practice on their birthday or, you know, at that holiday or New Year's or what have you. And they said, I just can't help myself. They recognize even they are a bit out of control. And then they tell me they crave it. If their child's not doing something that's directly related to practicing or getting better, they feel uncomfortable. It's like a withdrawal for them. So, I mean, I think that it's a way to understand or to make an analogy to something that's going on, and it's pervasive throughout our society. And I think that we really need to take a close look at the factors that have led us here. I certainly don't want to come as judgmental. I've been there. I start talking about, you know, with my first child, the mistakes that I made and had the pressure I felt. And the first section is called, This Doesn't Feel Right, But Everyone Else Is Doing It. And I'm taking my son to piano practice, and he's 4, and I look in the rearview mirror, and his face reminds me of my patients. His eyes are flat and empty, and it was like a moment of epiphany, and I turned the car around, and it was kind of the beginning of my journey to change and also the beginning of the book.
And you talk in the book about your own childhood. You say you had no scheduled activities, not one ever. You spent most of your time reading books and playing outside in Vancouver where you grew up. You had responsibilities around the house and were expected to do well in school. And you feel you would be a lot less likely to have been able to become a student, doctor, psychiatrist, and teacher without the freedom and responsibility you say defined your childhood.
Absolutely, yes. My parents were immigrants. I mean, most immigrant parents don't have the time or money or resources to hover over their children for 3 hours of piano, and most parents in general don't. So, you know, I grew up probably like many people of our generation, my generation, where there was responsibility at home, you know, doing dishes, putting laundry away. I personally was in no scheduled activities, never. But what there was a real focus on was not building the outside, which is what I'm seeing now, but building the inside. So talking a lot about character, talking a lot about values and honesty and work ethic and our place in the world and our impact that beyond ourselves. And we know, I found later on, many, many years later after I was doing my research in Harvard, that, wow, somehow, you know, my parents, my mom wasn't educated. She can't even read my book, actually. Somehow, they intuitively knew what was going to be highly motivating. And those were the messages of purpose, connection, and passion for your work. And it was quite a moment to realize that, you know, the highest level of science in this was completely in line with what my parents, with my mom particularly, with little education, were instilling in their own homes. And that's where I believe parenting is intuitive. I think that we don't need parenting experts. We need to slow down and get back to our intuition.
What about obstacles for kids, like the kids who have parents who are in a bad marriage or they come from a single-parent home?
So when we look closely at those kinds of data, in general, unless things are really traumatic, like we're talking about serious abuse in the home, child abuse in particular, if there's a strong attachment and connection, a strong relationship, we find kids are very resilient. The message there is, if you're a single parent, if there's been a messy divorce, those things are not insurmountable obstacles in raising a healthy, happy, self-motivated kid, as long as the relationship, the parent-child relationship, is positive. And that's true even for more extreme situations, children growing up in, you know, war and other in other areas. So the focus really there is build a relationship. And of course, life can be very difficult and challenging. And that sets a stage to understand later in life. And we know kids who have some adversity actually do better. There's one study I quote in the book. It was a research lab where they actually plunged people's hands in ice-cold water. And they found that those kids who had some adversity in childhood were able to tolerate the pain better and have less of a dramatic response than those kids who had absolutely, like, problem-free, let's say, childhood. So I'm not saying we create adversity on purpose, but it is part of life, and if our kids are exposed to it, work on your relationship and a parent themselves role modeling a healthy, balanced lifestyle is really the best way to deal with that.
We talked just at the beginning about how parents feel conflicted between their intuition and fear, really. If you're a dolphin living in a tiger's world, your fears are right in front of you all the time. And you use this example. You say if your neighbor's kid just won the spelling bee, it might make you want to go yank your kid out of the dirt and get them enrolled in a class. So how do we begin?
So what's really interesting about that and the fear response, I'm going to give you some neuroscience here, but fear and stress release what we call stress hormones. And these are, the main one is adrenaline. And that puts us into what we would call a freeze, fight, or flight response. And when we think of parenting behaviors, there's a lot of that going on. So the freeze is anxiety, overwhelm. The fight is irritability, tension, anger. The flight is kind of escape, checking out, just enrolling in tons of activities and driving around mindlessly, or whatever escape kind of mechanisms there might be. A lot of people are actually living, not just parents, but living in freeze, fight, or flight. And that's not a place of conscious choices. That's not a place of balance. So what I say is if you, anybody, any dolphin, these aren't labels, these are states of mind, and I wrote the book, I can easily turn into a tiger once I'm in that stress mode, once I'm in that fear mode. But so we have to remove ourselves, maybe not physically. I'm not going to go move neighborhoods or go live in a utopic village where nobody is competitive, but mentally move out of that space. Balance our brains out, calm down, make sure we're not sleep deprived, make sure we as a parent has enough rest and downtime and mindful thought of how we want to raise our kids. And then now we can make choices and we can interact with our world and make decisions for our children versus react from a freeze, fight, or flight place where we're on automatic drive.
We mentioned the depression and substance abuse being on the rise, and you point out that for the first time in human history, high economic status is also a risk factor for youth. Can you talk about the risks associated with privilege?
Yes. In fact, not just upper class, but upper middle class children are at high risk of all kinds of emotional, behavioral, mental health maladjustments. The list is quite shocking, even compared to, in some studies, even compared to inner city youth. We're seeing higher rates of substance use, particularly binge drinking. We're seeing higher rates of narcissistic behaviors. In fact, boys in elite private schools are showing the most narcissistic behaviors. This would be like the, you know, narcissism, the word comes from the Greek myth of the god who saw his reflection in a pool and fell in love with himself. So these are individuals who crave constant admiration and see themselves as grandiose, better than others. We know girls of upper middle class and middle class have a stronger connection with self-worth and external beauty than girls of middle class or lower class. There's more pressure on these girls to not just do well academically or athletically, but also to look perfect. So that pressure to do it all. We see more what we call somatic symptoms, so headache and back aches and stomach aches in children of upper class and upper middle class. And the trend is this is all getting worse, actually. And one of the theories behind it is there's lots of different theories, but one of them certainly is a pressured lifestyle of overscheduling, overinstructing, overprotecting, all of these things already mentioned. But the other is an environment of overfocus on the external image, the CV, and underfocus on the internal character, the internal drive, the internal sense of purpose and connection to anything beyond themselves.
This is Dr. Shimi Kang. She's an expert on human motivation and has written this book, The Self-Motivated Kid, How to Raise Happy, Healthy Children Who Know What They Want and Go After It Without Being Told. You say you've seen some kids who were lacking in some very basic needs like getting enough rest and fresh air.
Yes, you know, the extreme cases were coming from East Asian countries where in China kids were, during exam time, they're actually given IVs because they don't have time to eat or go to the bathroom, so they're kind of hooked up to these IVs. That's really extreme. But we know that in East Asian countries, 90% of the kids are nearsighted, and it's not hereditary. It's because of a lack of sunlight because they're indoors studying all day. We also know rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency because a lack of sunlight is increasing across the board. Of course, we know obesity is, and there's a connection there with sedentary behaviors. There are extremes. I talked about a young American girl named Samantha who was in competitive gymnastics. And when I asked her to tell me how much fresh air she had in a week, she had a really hard time because she went from her attached garage to school straight to the gym, and she did her hours and hours of gymnastics and then back home to study and do her tutoring. And in the end of the day, she was getting about 2 hours a week of fresh air and sunlight, outdoor space. So the other thing is that playing competitive soccer, playing hockey, or playing in gymnastics is not what we consider play from a brain-boosting standpoint. When we think of the play that is stress-relieving, that releases dopamine and makes us feel good and it really stimulates our brain, that is play without evaluation. So when parents tell me, oh, my kids play a lot, they play 6 hours of hockey a week or play soccer, I say, well, no, that's actually performance and practicing. That's all good stuff, but that's not what we would consider free play. Our lifestyles have become so off balance that really getting back to some basic definitions and basic awareness of what we need and what children need growing up has become really important.
What do we know about tiger cubs? In other words, kids who are raised with that tiger mother mentality, what kind of parents do they end up being themselves?
Great question. Well, we know that initially, I think the problem with tiger cubs is initially it all looks good. They're the kids, you know, that may be getting the grades or playing the piano better than everyone else. And that's because the small child can be externally driven, pushed, or bribed to a certain degree. But we know that that doesn't last. And in fact, study after study, including everywhere in the world, Chinese culture, American culture, European culture, that what we end up seeing is a lack of independent problem solving, which makes sense because they're constantly being told what to do and how to do it. A lack of creativity, which is terrible, because I mentioned creativity is one of the 21st century skills. Increase that level of anxiety, become perfectionism, and ultimately a lack of internal drive. They become dependent on external rewards and external pushing. The type of parent they become is actually, we could become all three types, but many tiger parents repeat what they were used to, what they experienced, and become the same. But many were so turned off by it, they felt so traumatized, or they have such an aversion to it that they actually become the worst jellyfish. Mm. So in my practice, I've seen so many jellyfish parents who have no rules. They have no expectations on their kids. And I'm like, what's going on? And they said, well, my parents push me too hard, and I don't want to do that to my kids. The answer is balance. It's this dolphin. It's firm and flexible. It's collaborative. It's authoritative, not authoritarian.
Your book is divided into four parts: the dilemma, the solution. We've talked about the dilemma. We've talked about some of the solutions. Let's go now to the third part of the book, which is taking action. And some of these are very basic.
Yes, absolutely. So there's 60 prescriptions. They're all for lifestyle and communication. And in fact, the first prescription is to take deep breaths, because taking the time to just slow down and take some deep breaths literally moves us out of that stress mode. It moves us to using our higher level of our brain, interacting with our environment, and making conscious choices. I talk about things like drinking enough water. I say these are simple but not easy. Drinking water is very simple, but 86% of Americans are chronically dehydrated. I have families in my office where, you know, the mom is drinking like a grande or venti Starbucks, and the child is drinking a Diet Coke, and everyone's sleep-deprived and dehydrated. Well, of course there's going to be tension and conflict in the family. So getting to the basics, sleep, water, slowing down are the first prescriptions. And then I move into the other natural motivators that have been neglected and, in fact, systematically kind of taken out of childhood, of which play is the primary one. And I get really deep into the science of play, into the different play types and which area of the brain they stimulate, and why play is so pervasive in the natural world. Dolphins play every day. Polar bears play every day. It's because it stimulates so many pathways in our brain. Play is what allows us to adapt. It's what allows us to become comfortable with uncertainty, to learn abstract concepts, to think strategically, to create and make new innovations. So the science of play is fascinating, and that's actually my favorite part of the book.
Mine too. And you do spend some time on play, and as you said, you go into the science of play. Did you want to say more?
Yes, I think that we have to remember or learn a little bit about play, because play shifted over the generations. And I use the example of Lego to explain that. So if we look at Lego of a generation ago, or Lego of my time, I say, it was simple bricks. There was no right or wrong way to use them. It was limitless in our imagination. It was brain-boosting. It was highly creative. The child was the lead, and they led the play. They got to decide if they were going to make a spaceship or a giraffe. And that's the play that I'm talking about that leads to adaptation and strategic thinking and stress reduction. The play of today is like today's Lego, in the sense that there's a picture on the box that tells you what you're supposed to make. And that's actually a microcosm of what's happening in childhood, because it's full of rules and full of structure, and there's no imagination. And the child is not leading. The child is following these directions. And you make one mistake, and the whole thing falls apart. And it's perfectionistic, rigid, and fragile. And I think that when we look at just that one example of play and Lego, we can really see how the play has changed. You don't need fancy toys and gadgets. Remember how we played? We played with sticks and dirt and leaves and our own bodies and twirling around and friends, and that's the brain-boosting kind of play that children of today need. And to really remember that, like, we use play therapy as a psychiatrist. I have a 4-month waiting list, and many of our patients who come to our clinic, we just play with them. We use play therapy for anxiety, depression, ADHD, all kinds of stuff, trauma. You know, Mother Nature is our parents' best ally. And if we remember that and it becomes natural to kids, I say we don't need a lot of fancy stuff. We just don't want to stand in the way of what's naturally children are driven towards. And for sure, that's play.
Have you seen children who don't know how to play?
Yes, I think more and more. And I'm seeing parents who tell me my child doesn't know how to play. Or they'll tell me that, you know, my child wants all these activities. They're asking me for them for all these activities. And I say, well, if you grow up in a box, you crave that box. And if a child at the age of 3 or 4 has been in structured activities, then that's all they know and are familiar with. Humans love to play. Human children love to play. And it might take a little bit of guidance, a little bit of redirection, but all children will eventually be able to play. There's 7 different kinds of play personalities. Some are the collectors. So, like, you know, think of the collectors of stuffed animals or coins in the past. Some are the storytellers. Some are what we call body movement players. Those are the kids that love to do cartwheels and twirl around. So, you know, there's different play personalities. Not everyone plays the same, but it is in all of us to play. Adults, too.
Are there consequences later in life from lack of play?
Yeah, so I think of play deprivation a lot like sleep deprivation, and because we're internally driven towards both of those, luckily we can catch up on both of those too. So, but if you think of a sleep-deprived child, they're cranky, they're irritable, they're exhausted, they're unmotivated. And we see the exact same stuff in a play-deprived child. Later in life, because of that lack of adaptability, we see individuals who've been deprived of play having more anxiety. They have a hard time thinking out of the box or around obstacles. Because play is a natural stress reduction, it's an emotional regulator. The most profound example came out of Dr. Stuart Brown, who's a psychiatrist who has done a lot of research on play. He found a correlation, believe it or not, between mass murderers and play deprivation in childhood. That when you look in the last 50 years of individuals who were committing these mass murderers, and looked into their childhood background as a forensic psychiatrist, the commissions that reviewed these cases found that the lack of play in childhood was a pervasive common factor. So I think that's the most extreme case, but I certainly in my practice see anxiety associated with depression, associations with rigidity and perfectionistic thinking. And it all makes sense because play gives us the belief that we have a certain sense of control, we can learn from trial and error, we can adapt, we can adjust, we can change. And those are very core beliefs to understand life, that when things go wrong, we can adapt, we can change, when trial and error occurs in real life, we can recover from it. Play really sets the stage, the foundations for optimism and resiliency and the ability to adapt.
This is Dr. Shimi Kang. She's a child psychiatrist, an expert on human motivation in Vancouver, and she's written this latest book called The Self-Motivated Kid. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to focus on the last part of the book called Transformation. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. I'm talking with Dr. Shimi Kang. She's a child psychiatrist in Vancouver. Her most recent book, which we're talking about today, is The Self-Motivated Kid. So let's get to the self-motivation part, which we've been leading up to. This is the last part of the book, which you call transformation. And you say self-motivation is the holy grail of parenting and of all human happiness.
Yes. So if we have self-motivation, now we have the engine for all kinds of success, that broad definition of success. Because when there's a health issue, the self-motivated individual will figure it out. They will do the physiotherapy. They will lose the weight. They will quit smoking. They'll manage their cholesterol, whatever it is. The self-motivated person will be able to sort out, problem solve, and overcome obstacles, you know, in their personal life and professional life. So yes, it's the holy grail of parenting and life. And when we look at self-motivation, it comes from 3 main things. It comes from a sense of autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So autonomy gets back to our belief that we control our lives, not completely, but a belief that our own choices, our own critical thinking, our own ability to solve problems matters. And that's what the tiger kids don't develop, nor do the jellyfish kids develop that. It's that dolphin collaborative, early, firm but flexible approach that really instills that sense of autonomy, of self-reliance. The second is mastery, and then we have purpose. Mastery comes from doing something that you're good at, and people kind of falsely run to say, well, oh, there you go, you have to push piano, you have to push math, but you have to like what you're good at. And we know that curiosity is a natural fuel of mastery, and this is where play comes in. So if a child can find something that they enjoy and they want to practice that, and there's a sense of curiosity for them to go further to the next level, they'll push boundaries. They'll push themselves intellectually to go after it. That's where play develops mastery over kind of pushy external practice. Now, of course, someone may say, well, how, my kid doesn't like math, but they have to, you know, get through grade 5 math. So then what? And then that's the third ingredient of motivation, which is purpose. So you can have a child and say, look, you hate math, but there's a purpose behind math. If you want to get to grade 6, you just have to know it. Or if you want to eventually become a veterinarian, you have to get through this level. And when we're shoulder to shoulder with our children, the dolphin metaphor is shoulder to shoulder, not face to face, in terms of authoritarian, but authoritative. We can take anything and be with them and say, you know what, you're right. Your grade 11 subjects don't make any sense for what you want to do. You want to be a graphic designer. But what would be the purpose of doing them? Not because you like them or because I think they're important, because you're in a system that requires you to do them. So purpose can be looked at that way. And the more motivating way, the most motivating way, is purpose beyond something, valuing something beyond ourselves.
So as we're just starting a new school year, what advice would you give to parents to help develop some of these healthier habits?
So I always like to give a prescription for an acronym, and it stands for Play Others in Downtime, and it can be remembered through the word POD, P-O-D. And POD is the community of dolphins, so it fits well with the dolphin parenting. The P is play. We already talked a lot about that. Adolescents need to play, and for them, play may be exploring an interest, taking an elective, taking a class without worrying about the mark or evaluation. This is an essential part of adolescence, is intellectual exploration. The O is others. So remember that connection is really important. Connection is what leads to our sense of purpose, and it's highly motivating. So we want to really look for social bonding, not necessarily socializing. There's a difference. So if the family's all having dinner together in the car because they're all off to different activities, that's not a good thing. You want to plan for some family dinners. The family dinner has scientifically been shown as one of the most powerful activities of childhood to improve academic performance, reduce drug and alcohol problems, all kinds of stuff. So remember the O, remember the others. Make sure your child has good, strong social connections to somebody. And then the D is downtime. Make sure that you're making sleep a priority, that there is some downtime in the day, some moments of contemplation, some moments of quiet, some moments of reflection. I always tell the story of a girl who was referred to me for ADHD because she was constantly staring out her window looking at the trees and the clouds, and she didn't have ADHD at all. She was just so busy that she never had time to stare out the window and just contemplate life and look at the trees and the clouds. So kids and adults need downtime. That prescription, a daily dose of play, others, and downtime, will help mitigate all these other pressures that are occurring. They're just pervasive in our society.
We've talked a lot about some of the problems that kids have experienced. Can you tell one of the stories from the book where some of these techniques led to a successful outcome?
Yes. So a story that comes to mind is a boy I talk about in the book. I called him Aaron, and he's a typical grade 8 student. His parents brought him to me because they were worried he was lacking motivation, maybe depressed. His grades were dropping. He was kind of withdrawn and glum in the home. really irritable, cranky. You know, when I meet with young people like that, I always take an inventory of their lifestyle, and then I take an inventory of what's happening in the relationship. And in the lifestyle, there were some problems, but could quite easily be solved. One, he wasn't getting enough sleep, had a hard time juggling his homework, all his activities, and then the only thing he found relaxing was video games. So we were able to really look at his lifestyle and ask him to make choices and to cut back just a little bit of activity, a little bit of video games, even a little bit of homework, because he was kind of taking too much time and was inefficient in what he was doing. We looked at, you know, his diet, drinking water, some simple things. But then we looked at his connection, that bonding I talked about. And one of the things that was really bringing him down was that his brother, who was 2 years older than him, had recently made the rugby team in high school and was really busy himself. He was missing his brother. And he was also worried about his brother because his brother had had a concussion and he was being pushed pretty hard by his coach to keep playing. So that was actually a big discovery from Aaron's parents because they totally missed that connection. They actually thought Aaron may have been jealous that his brother made the team and didn't have time for him. So really remembering that our basics of lifestyle, our basics of connection are vitally important. Aaron also didn't have any play, even though he was in grade 8. He actually loved science, and he didn't like his teacher because his teacher was very instruction-based, and he wanted to experiment. He wanted to try some interesting things. So we got him to sign up for the science club at school, which was not based on evaluation, but was based on just learning science without having to worry about what ended up on your report card. So some simple adjustments really helped Aaron. And then when we looked at the relationship, the parents were flip-flopping between tiger and jellyfish. You know, they'd be on him about homework and activities and not playing video games, but they were both working parents. And then they'd become jellyfish because they would be exhausted and they couldn't deal with it, so they just let him play video games. And so really helping the parents balance out their style to be more balanced, to be more collaborative, to be more of that dolphin parent where there's clear rules and expectations, but there's flexibility. That really helped not just Aaron, but his entire family. A prescription I gave everyone was for sleep. I gave everyone the prescription to connect, everyone to have a meal or two or three together as a family, if possible. And I actually write them on prescription pads because I want families to understand that a prescription for a family meal or a prescription to sleep or a prescription to play and explore your hobbies and interests is as important, and it's not more important or serious than a prescription for medication because it will prevent that prescription for medication. So I write them right on my prescription pad.
What's the one thing you want people to take away from this book?
Oh my goodness, there's so much. But I think I want to say that parenting is simple but not easy. And I think I want to underline that it's simple. We don't need all of the gadgets, the toys, the tutors, the excessives. If we look at people who are innovators and doing well, many of their childhood stories don't include all of that. So remembering that the basics are the most important. Nobody is going to be brilliant if they're sleep deprived and, you know, stressed and dehydrated. But that's not easy. So that's the second part, is that it's not easy to not be caught up in these pressures, that we're all in it together, and to support ourselves and to give ourselves a break when we make mistakes. And just like in our modern world, the new parenting issues are dealing with, let's say, technology. Parents a generation ago didn't have to deal with iPads. Well, this generation of parents has to deal with a busy, hurried, unsustainable lifestyle. And that's not something parents a generation before had to deal with. We have to accept it, and we have to buffer our children against it. And then you'll find things become much easier. You'll have a child who develops that CQ, that creativity, collaboration, communication, critical thinking, a child who is both healthy in body and mind, happy and has that self-motivation.
It's an interesting conversation. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Shimi Kang, she's the medical director for child and youth mental health for Vancouver. The name of the book is The Self-Motivated Kid: How to Raise Happy, Healthy Children Who Know What They Want and Go After It Without Being Told. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.